Good evening and welcome to another episode of Nigeria Politics Weekly. My name is Michael and co-hosting with me is Phoenix. Today we have two guests. Our first guest is Ose. Ose is a member of the PDP as well as a hotelier. Our second guest is Famile. Famile works for the Nigerian government. Now we have four topics we'll be discussing today. Our first topic is we'll be discussing Buhari's recent TV interview with Channels TV. Secondly, we'll discuss the news reports that Vice President Osibanjo has apparently told President Buhari that he is interested in running for the presidency in 2023. Thirdly, we'll discuss Buhari's appointment of Doyin Salami as his chief economic advisor. And finally, we'll discuss the proposal by the governor of Kaduna State, Nasu El-Rufai, that the forests of northern Nigeria should be carpet bombed to get rid of the so-called bandits in the forest. So firstly, to Phoenix, Buhari, after what many will call a long period of silence, decided to grant what Channels TV called an exclusive interview. And the interview generated a lot of interest on social media. Some people described it as a car crash, whilst others said that was Buhari's best or most lucid interview to date. So, Phoenix, can you explain to us why did an interview with the president generate so much discourse? And secondly, why is it an exclusive? Is it normal for a president to be given exclusive interviews? Phoenix?
Hello, Michael. And hi, Famile and Ose. Thanks for joining us on this show. And hello, listeners. Thanks for being there. well, you know, you have to go with what the norm is, right? So we've had our president for two terms now. He's more than halfway through his second term, and we know that he's not used to giving interviews. So it is an exclusive in that regard, in the sense that he doesn't do this normally, and whenever he does it, it's a big deal. Because he gives people an opportunity to get an insight into what he thinks, and you know, not from a properly scripted speech. That, I mean, he sticks to his talking points. I mean, hopefully, you can gain something from the questioning. Albeit that, I mean, as the Channels guy said, they had to send their questions ahead of time, And of course, it means that at least there's some guidance for him in terms of what's coming. But you still get to hear his thoughts. So from that perspective, I think, yeah, they were right to call it an exclusive. Now, to your question, should a president be giving exclusives? I think presidents do give exclusives. If we look at the previous presidents that we had, I mean, Goodluck used to have his presidential media chat, but anything outside of that on a one-to-one basis with a particular media house would be termed an exclusive. So it's just a function of how Buhari has chosen to run his own presidency in terms of how he's accessible to his people, in terms of how he talks to them and how he decides that he wants to speak with them. I think to the other point you made, which you said about people having divergent views about how the interview went, with some saying it was his most lucid, with some other people saying it was a car crash. I think it's always a matter of perspective. I think he did sound lucid to me, but again, but that's because the bar is already low in my view. We're used to him being incoherent, so him sitting through a 40-minute interview and being able to respond was a good thing. But of course, as with Buhari, you would see him go off tangent or not understand the question or stick to certain points that he's made up in his mind that these are the things he's going to talk about and his own perspective, his own view. I mean, you ask him about insecurity, as relates to farmers, and he tells you security has improved in the north, and then now we're seeing attacks that have killed almost 200 people just right after his interview. You reel out economic numbers to him that are coming out from his own government, and then he tells you he doesn't know where you're getting the numbers from. So it was nothing to be surprised about if you studied him for a while. So my take from it was just a confirmation of what we've had and what we've seen over the time of his presidency.
Thank you, Phoenix. Let me first of all go to Famile, when we get to the substance of some of Buhari's responses, as Phoenix said, I can give you another example. He was asked about state police, and his response was that the option, state policing was not an option. Well, the problem is the APC in 2015 and 2019 ran on the promise of restructuring. In fact, they even set up a restructuring committee. And one of the things it recommended was state police. And the governors had been telling us that, yes, we support restructuring. In fact, Kaede Fayemi, who is the chairman of the APC governors forum, actually said that state policing was on the agenda, and they presented a bill to the legislature on this issue. But Buhari is saying the opposite, that it's not an option. So why does there appear to be so much confusion in this APC government, Family?
Okay, all right. Thank you very much for this question. To the best of my understanding, I think the part of the restructuring promised by APC, I think at a certain time they denied that they never promised restructuring anyway. But at the same time, there have been a lot of diverse views when it comes to restructuring and according to one's understanding about restructuring, okay? And yes, I know there was a committee set up. I think RFI set up was part of that committee that brought about a draft copy of how the country should be restructured. Sorry, you get what I mean. So, but I don't know what must have come up with the final draft of what his committee came up with. But from the interview, and like I said, the whole state police, it's been a debate of a state police relevant now. Can it work in Nigeria? Is it what we need? Is it the only way to cut security? It's always been a debate over time. Some believe that's the best way for us to curb the insecurity in the country. Some believe it's the right time for Nigeria to shift from federal policing into state policing, while some believe it's going to be abused by the governors. Now, when the president was asked this question, he said something about how have the governors or the government in the state treated the local government. All right. And I believe there's a bit of wisdom in what he was saying. When we're talking about state policing, it's more of local policing. It's more of giving the local government to have enough powers to be able to stand on their own and be able to have their government of their own to stand and do what the local government have the powers to do. And he's looking at it like, I have tried as much as possible from the president. I'm trying to read what he's trying to say is to give local government autonomy. But the state governments are still strangling the local governments. They have not still given them the full autonomy. Are they getting what they are supposed to get? I think he said something like that. Are they even getting what they are supposed to get? So in his own terms, he's looking at it like, all right, you want state police, but the state governors themselves are not even ready for it. Even their own little local governments that they are in charge, that's supposed to have to be standing on their own or have their own autonomy, you are not even allowing them. You give them the funds come in, you see that what is meant for the local government, they don't get exactly what is allocated. So at the same time, when we now look at the other side of what you're talking about, state police, we'll see that at the same time, it can still be abused too. So it's just a debate here and there and trying to understand the Nigerian system and what really works for Nigeria. Yes, I think it's high time where we have, where from, in my own opinion, where states should be able to control security, where at least the local man knows the people in his local environment. They can point out who is the criminal amongst them, or, you know, the person in that local environment will know who are the people troubling the local, not a foreigner, bringing a foreigner to come and curb insecurity in a village he knows nothing about or knows anything about. Yes, but at the same time, we have to look at the other side about the abuse of it, the local government being standing on its own, having their own full autonomy to be able to do what they are supposed to do. So in my own take, you know, we need to look deeply and begin to see how it can work and how the state government can even allow local government to function in full capacity before we can start to talk about state policing.
Thank you, Famile. Let me go to Ose. Ose, the summary of what Famile is saying, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, but Famile seems to be implying that President Buhari is right because the state governors have not been respecting federalism in the way they've been treating local governments. They've been abusing their powers. And his view is that, therefore, if states are given the right to control policing, they will also abuse their powers. So that seems to be Buhari's logic. Now, Ose, does Buhari's logic sit well with you? Do you agree with Famile's view?
Thank you, guys. Happy New Year. I think this is the first time I'm coming on this year. So happy New Year. I just want to say you guys are doing an amazing job with this podcast. I saw one of your tweets and it was like, you guys have done like almost 1,000 or 10,000 interviews. I didn't know it had been going on for so long. But I just want to say you guys should keep on the good work. I think just the quality of the conversation you managed to curate is what sets this podcast away from others, which is why you're going to have to excuse me because I'm going to have to lean really hard into what Famile said because it's almost as dishonest as Buhari's interview. And I just want to, you know, I don't, with Buhari, you know, it's an exclusive, it was an exclusive interview. And sometimes you sort of like get a sense as to why, you know, he breaks the veil and comes out to address Nigerians. He usually does it around election time, just before elections. He's on almost all the TV stations talking, trying to rally the troops, trying to show proof of life. And you understand that, or when there's a major incident like the Zaria Shiite massacre, he was on TV defending that as well. For the life of me, I could not understand why he gave that interview. Because it didn't hit any of the markers it should have hit. It didn't answer any questions. And it just revealed how out of touch, you know, he really is with governance. You know, so for instance, you know, we talk about, you know, and I said, you know, the interview was dishonest. You hear Buhari always say when he's asked about restructuring, what does restructuring mean? It means many things to many people. And to him, it's then logical to say, because it means many things to many people, I'm not going to do anything about it. That's not what governance is. It doesn't matter what PDP thinks restructuring is, or what APGAD thinks, or what Mogalu thinks, or IBB. You are the president. What does restructuring mean to you? And it is that understanding of restructuring that you then need to put out and push out and try and implement. As per your promises in 2013, 2014, 2015, 2018, 2019, you are right. The APC has a position on what restructuring means. They have a white paper that has been submitted to the president. So anybody coming on any podcast or any platform saying restructuring means many things to many people, I'm not interested in that. Tell us what restructuring means to the APC and then implement it. It can be as simple as that. You know, so again, I don't understand what the interview means. He was asked about state police very clearly. And then he says some governors came to see him. Shane Makinde came to see him. I don't know if you guys remember the issue Shane Makinde was having in Oyo with the farmer herders crisis. He came to the president to say, look, we need state police. We need licenses for weapons for Amotekun in the southwest. And Buhari sent him back. And he came on television to say, I sent him back because he should go and speak to the local leaders and find out how they used to handle this farmer herder crisis centuries ago. I don't think that's a serious president. It bothers me, you know, the entire interview. And you know, I have 3 minutes, I think, but I was just so concerned about everything he said. You know, even the doing salami thing, you know, it was dishonest, it was ignorant. He came and said he's going to push his whole economic plank, his whole economic policy on the fact that 2.5% of arable land in Nigeria is cultivated. That's a lie. His own Federal Ministry of Information and Culture reported during Salami as saying that 2.5% of all arable land that is being cultivated is irrigated. The amount of arable land in Nigeria is about 90%, cultivated is about 40%. Irrigated is 2.5%, but the president somehow hears 2.5% is irrigated, is cultivated, and is then trying to push his whole economic policy to tell everybody to go back to land because only 2.5% of Nigeria's arable land is being cultivated. It was ignorant, it was dishonest, and I really don't know why his handlers, with the fact that they got the questions in advance, exposed the president to that kind of ridicule.
Thank you, Bose, for your response to the question. Now to Phoenix. Another issue that I wanted to touch on was on the question of IPOB and Nnamdi Kanu, because Buhari was asked his view whether or not he would release Nnamdi Kanu, and he said, no, we cannot release him. Because in his words, he seemed to be implying that people need to behave themselves before they are released. And I saw there was a lot of commentary on social media about the fact that the militants, for example, in the Niger Delta have received an amnesty, that even Boko Haram terrorists in the north have received amnesties, as well as the bandits. So why has he taken this hardline stance on Nnamdi Kanu? So the question to you, Phoenix, is do you agree with Buhari's position, or do you think Nnamdi Kanu should be set free?
I think the way I look at the Nnamdi Kanu issue is I don't think the Nigerian government has made enough of a case as to why, I mean, as to what they're charging him with, unless I've missed it. So for me, to that extent, he hasn't. I mean, when you heard him speak during the interview, he was saying something about he has to answer for what he has done. He cannot stay abroad and be abusing us. So I was like, is that what he's being held for? Or are you holding him as a terrorist or as somebody who was, you know, taking up arms against the state? What really, I'm not clear. You know, whenever they take him to court, he's always shrouded in mystery. And to that end, and also how they picked him up was, all, I mean, you've also not actually done the right thing in how you've even managed the whole affair. So in my view, I mean, if you're not coming to this with clean hands, then you might as well do the right thing and let him go. But if there is a case, if there is a clear case of him having risen up against the state or taking up arms against the state and led to deaths of security officials and all of those kind of things, then he has a case to answer, and he must answer to that case, and they should not release him. But I've not seen the Nigerian state, the Nigerian government, make enough of a case against this guy beyond he was abusing us or he has been ridiculing Buhari, and therefore that is not, you don't use the instrument of state to assuage your own ego. And that's all that seems to come out on this case. And that's what we heard him saying during the interview. So to that extent, I totally disagree that he continues to hold on to him. Make the right case and tell us that the guy has committed treason. Tell us that he's a terrorist and show reason why you believe so. And then properly charge him to court. That's what sane societies do. And that's where we need to be. And if you look historically, some of the issues that we've had, I mean, take into account the extrajudicial killing of Mohamed Yusuf that led to the Deco Aid old struggle that we've had with Boko Haram. It's all of those nonsense that the Nigerian state, the law enforcement, the military people, you know, do something wrong, and then it snowballs into something bigger than it should be. You need, I mean, if there is a clear case, you've investigated and you are sure that this guy was involved in certain things or was instigating certain things, then make that clear to the public and then prosecute him normally. But they haven't done that. And to the extent that you haven't done that, you continue to create the feeling that there's some unfairness going on. And then you allow people to feed on that and it becomes something that it shouldn't. So in my view, if they cannot prove their case, they should let him go.
Thank you, Phoenix. Let me bring in Famile to ask him the final question on this topic. Famile, as you've heard from Phoenix, Phoenix sort of disagrees with Buhari that, first of all, Buhari doesn't seem to understand what Nnamdi Kanu is being held for, because Buhari keeps saying he was in Europe abusing us and spreading false information about the economy. But I'm not so sure that that is justification to kidnap him from Kenya and bring him to Nigeria. So there are two questions, is one for you, Famile, and we have about 3 minutes for you to give your response. So firstly, do you agree that Nnamdi Kanu should not be released? And secondly, Buhari said in general on insecurity, he has done well. So do you agree with Buhari that on insecurity, he has done well? So those are the two questions. I need a quick answer from you, Famile.
All right, thank you very much. And regarding Nnamdi Kanu, and I don't think there's anybody that will say the government has not been clear about the case against Nnamdi Kanu. Whether it is, you say you don't understand that IPOB has been proscribed as a terrorist group, whether it is done sentimentally or it's not supposed to be a terrorist group, but the government of the day has proscribed IPOB to be a terrorist group. I don't know if my brother Phoenix have forgotten that the Sedun Nnamdi Kanu jumped bail. He was on bail and jumped bail and fled to the UK. I don't know if you've forgotten about that. All right. But if you listen to the interview of what the president said, he said, I do not interfere with the judiciary. Let him have his day in court. I don't interfere. I will not release him. Let him, if he can stand outside and they are holding him or insulting us from outside, he should defend himself. If the court, I don't interfere with the judiciary. So I'm not here to defend if Nnamdi Kanu is being held unfairly, or I'm not here to come and defend the government on that or defend Nnamdi Kanu, but I'm going to just tell you as it is or what the president has said. He will have his day in court. Let him go through the judiciary process. I'm not going to release him. Let him follow the rule of law. If they find him guilty, in my own opinion, that's fine. If he's not going to be guilty, fine. But let him face the judiciary. Now, on the part of whether Buhari has done well in security or is underperforming in security, well, it's a coin with two sides. Looking from when he took over as a president, the level of the insecurity and the insecurity that has taken a new dimension, you know. So it's I can't really place the president at the moment, because presently we just finished hearing a very sad news that happened in Zamfara and the loss of lives, you know. When he took over the government from in 2015, I knew then we used to have a lot of suicide bombings. It was more Boko Haram and suicide bombings. We've been able to curb that side a bit. And now insecurity took another dimension into headsmen. And from headsmen, we don't hear much of headsmen anymore. Now it's now full banditry ravaging the whole nut. And every day we hear they are bombarding them. Tomorrow we hear they are killing villagers. So I cannot place him, whether I can't really say at the moment, because when it comes to security, it's a very, very sensitive, is a sensitive part that you just don't delve in and begin to say who is performing or who is underperforming. But in my own opinion, I believe a president should not be happy seeing a lot of people dying, loss of lives, which he has sworn an oath to protect. So, and I believe he's doing his best presently to what I believe he has tried to release enough funds and he has, and to buy more equipment for the military. And like I always say, if you do not understand the northern terrain, you will not understand insecurity in the northern part of Nigeria, because it's not just, like I always say, Sambisa Forest itself is as big as the Northeast. I mean, as big as the Southeast. So what do we have on ground? Our soldiers on ground, the equipment's on ground, you know? So that will lead us to another topic on the statement El-Rufai said about bombarding the whole forest. So for now, I cannot grade the president whether he's performing or underperforming at the moment, because insecurity and the banditry in the north is a different dimension, and you just don't delve into it if you don't have sufficient information. Thank you.
Thank you, family. Also, Michael,
just very quick one, because I mean, okay, we don't let people come on the podcast and just say stuff. So when Famile says Nnamdi Kanu jumped bail, he should tell the whole story now, because we know that Nnamdi Kanu was granted bail and he was sitting in his house when the Nigerian military decided to attack him in his house. So who was the first to act in bad faith? He was supposed to sit there and wait to be killed while on bail. That's the point that we're trying to justify here. And then when we say the Nigerian state, as Nigerian government proscribed IPOB as terrorists. So whenever you have a group that is not violent, not doing anything, but is agitating, you can simply label them terrorists so that you can arrest them and kill them. That is the kind of democracy that we're talking about. Because that's what I'm trying to understand. I mean, the government can come out, so any government can come out and simply say, you're a terrorist because I do not agree with your views.
Phoenix, my brother, if you listen to what I said I'm not here to defend why the government prescribed IPOB. It's not what we're talking about. No, the question is very simple.
Justification.
Yeah. I'm just trying to let you know that if you say, but it is what is on record, whether the government has acted in bad faith or it is not constitutionally right for them to prescribe IPOB as a terrorist, but right now we all have to accept it.
We don't accept despotic government.
Sorry,
guys.
Sorry, guys.
Both of you are speaking over each other. Famile, please wait for Phoenix to talk and then you talk. Otherwise, we're talking over each other. So, Famile, you go. I mean, Phoenix, you go first. And then
I'm done. The point is, we do not accept despotic governments making despotic proclamations. You cannot simply wake up and say somebody is a terrorist because they don't agree with you. There has to be clear, justifiable reasons why you would label them as terrorists. It is widely accepted in the country that the government did not follow the correct path to label them as terrorists. So now using that as a justification for what for responding when I say that the government has not made a clear case against Nnamdi Kanu, then we need to take you up on that. It's very simple.
Okay. No, thank you, Phoenix, for your response. And family, we've also noted your response, but we need to move on to the next topic. Oh, is that Osei's hand? Osei, did you want to say something quickly? 1 minute, Osei. Was that you?
Yes, very quickly. So to try and find a middle ground in this entertaining conversation. So Phoenix is absolutely correct that there was no justification to label IPOB a terrorist group when Buhari did. We saw a lot more restraint in labeling the bandits the terrorist movement. I think it took them almost 4 years of constant pressure and depth before they finally conceded. But however, we have also seen IPOB evolve from a peaceful separatist group to one that is not so peaceful. They've acquired a violent, vicious bite. And Nnamdi Kanu, I've heard the videos. I've seen the videos. I've heard him actually incite violence and call for violence against the Nigerian government. So, you know, there has been an evolution, but, you know, I think we all understand that it was an evolution that was forced by the actions of the Buhari government. I just wanted to put that out.
Thank you very much, Osef, for that. That's a clear explanation. Thank you very much for that.
Yes, so thank you, guys. So let's move on to our next topic, which is the Vice President, Yemi, I think it's Osinbajo. Some people say it's Osinbajo, so apologies if I've mispronounced his name, has apparently notified President Buhari of his intention to run for office in 2023. And according to newspaper reports, this is from the People's Gazette, it says Buhari has not given an indication yet whether or not he supports his aspiration. So my first question to Famile, let me start with you. Do you think the Vice President Osinbajo is a good candidate to succeed Buhari? Do you think he's worthy of being Buhari's successor?
Yes. From my own opinion, I believe he's a good candidate and he should try and contest for it if he has the chance and given the opportunity to. So.
Well, thank you. No, the follow-up to that is many people have said his record in office is tied to Buhari's record in office. Inflation is up. It's at record levels. The economy has witnessed two recessions under their government. Insecurity is at record levels. Unemployment is high. So on what basis would you say President Osinbajo or Vice President Osinbajo is qualified to succeed the president? On what record is he going to run on, Famile?
Well, I'm not here to argue about your statistics on the unemployment. Everyone can argue about that. The Buhari government will give you their own analysis and their own statistics and facts of what they met on ground and what they are doing. And we from the outside will always give our own facts and statistics about that. Yes, he's the vice president, is under the government. We are not trying to remove him or try to say he's not part of the government if the government is failing. All right, you asked the question and I answered and said he is a good candidate on my side. It's a different thing when you're a vice president and when you are the president. So I believe he has every opportunity, like each and every Nigerian, to contest. Even now, you've given us, okay, the statistics on ground or based on insecurity, based on unemployment or recessions. Every government has always faced challenges. Even there's no country that are not facing challenges. But like I said, he should be given his own opportunity. I'm not here to come and argue what the government is doing economically or trying to change the statistics of the day. Presently, I don't have so much information on such statistics, I don't try to delve into it and begin to say what I don't know on a podcast. So for me, I'm a very, very, very good follower of Osinbajo, and I believe if given the opportunity, he will do better. And he's an energetic man at the moment, and he can do his best, yeah, if given the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you, Famile. I'm going to go to Phoenix and then come to Osef. Now, Phoenix, you've heard Famile's response. I gave him the data that I got that data from the Nigerian Bureau of Statistics. But Famile has said, well, people have their own data. Buhari government has their own data. So nobody quite knows whether or not the Buhari Osinbajo administration have performed well. So the question to you is, do you think, Phoenix, that he's a worthy candidate, and do you think he has a solid record to run on?
I think, I mean, number one, I, in my view, anyone who's vice president is a heartbeat away from the presidency. So unless the decision to choose him as a running mate was bad in the first instance, I mean, if you're already a vice president, you should be aspiring to be president. So it would be hilarious for me if he doesn't put his hat in the ring. Now, do I think he's fit for, I mean, do I think he's a good candidate? And I'll look at that in the prism of Nigeria in our context. And of course, we know that the battle is always between the two major parties, APC and PDP. So when I look within the APC, I think there are a lot, I mean, there are a lot worse people within that party when you look at Osinbajo. And so when I look at him within his party, I would say, yes, he is at the top of the pile looking across. Now, do I think he should become the next president of Nigeria? No. And my reason is very to the point that you are making. I do not believe in rewarding failure. I believe he is part and parcel of the Buhari government. I believe the APC itself, the whole party, should pay for the 8 years of destruction that we've had. And so there's no reason why anybody carrying the flag of the APC should come anywhere near the presidency, in my view. If this is a serious-minded country with serious-minded people who understand that failure should not be rewarded, you've had 8 years as a government, as a party, and you've given us nothing but backwardness, that needs to mean something. And so to that extent, while he is, in my view, because really my preference, and I've said this over and over again, is that the presidency should go to the Southeast. But even when I look at the whole APC, I don't see anybody there from the Southeast that makes any sense. So if I were to choose from the APC, yes, I would rather go with an Osinbajo, who, to all intents and purposes, seems better than the rest. But having been part of this government, having been the number two man in this government, I do not believe that should be rewarded with the presidency. So in my view, his party entirely should not even be in the running.
Thank you, Phoenix. But as to re-ask, sorry, I'm just making up English words, to ask the question again, Famile has said, and I think Buhari has made this point, that you are relying on data and they have their own data.
No, but the, so you are saying, but the data comes from them now, Michael. So all this story that Buhari is, all of a sudden, we're now finding out that the data that comes out of the Nigerian Bureau of Statistics, data that comes out of the DMO, the Debt Management Office, data that comes out of Ministry of Finance, is no longer reliable. That the Buhari government does not believe data coming out from its own institutions. I've never heard that kind of thing before in my life. It's not as if we're picking data from World Bank or from Phoenix's consulting firm. This is data that is freely available from institutions of government. I don't understand. And we are letting that stand. We're letting Buhari say that, and it's now, I mean, people are going to defend that.
Well, thank you, Phoenix. Let me bring in Osef for a different perspective. Osef, Phoenix has said that of the pack within the APC, Osinbajo is the most effective and let's say the one you can hold your nose to support. Now, I know you're a member of the PDP. My question to you is Osinbajo your nightmare candidate? Do you think the PDP is able to put up a strong fight if he is the candidate?
Famile has put me in a difficult situation because he didn't project, I think, his defense of the vice president strongly enough. And so I'm forced to step in and intervene. So do I think vice president Osinbajo would make a good president? I think he would. And for me, it's the evidence not of the APC government or Buhari, but of what he has done. I recall when he was acting president and how everyone saw a marked difference in the tone and temperament of government compared to when Buhari, before Buhari left and after Buhari came back. And for instance, you recall the sacking of Daura. We all know it wouldn't have happened. The DSS boss that invaded the National Assembly, it wouldn't have happened if Buhari was president. It was Osinbajo that, you know, averted the constitutional crisis when he submitted the name of Onoghen, the Chief Justice of Nigeria, when Buhari refused to make that submission. I recall when we were having a rise in violence in the southeast and south-south at that time. Again, because of the language that Buhari had employed, and Osinbajo took a tour of the southeast and south-south and sort of like calmed nerves. I've sat in rooms and heard Osinbajo, whilst the government was trying to clamp down on free speech, come out and say publicly that he doesn't think the government has any business regulating speech, and these platforms and users of these platforms should rather be the ones regulating speech. I recall when in reaction to the farmer herders crisis, Osinbajo and all the governors in Nigeria came up with a National Livestock Transformation Plan. And it was Buhari's government with Abba Kyari, and I think the Agric Minister at the time, that scuttled it by trying to introduce Ruga. And they even went ahead to start awarding contracts to the execution of, for the building of this Ruga settlement. So the point where the vice president had to come out to say that his plan has nothing to do with what these other guys are trying to execute. I've also seen him deliberately reach out to the young population and the tech community specifically. And I think maybe the problem with an Osinbajo presidency or all these good things he has done is that they seem to be running, you know, not even parallel, at in a totally 180 degree direction from what his boss is doing. You know, so it almost feels sometimes like Osinbajo is opposition even within his own government. Again, I recall when Buhari was breathing fire and brimstone about the SARS, the end SARS protests and the Lekki Toge shooting. Osinbajo is the only government official today that has come out to acknowledge the deaths and to put out a sort of apology. You might say it wasn't enough. People say he should have resigned if it was really remorseful. But these things sort of like lead me to believe that this man, you know, would be a different leader from Buhari. And for me, you know, if you ask me the question as a PDP man, you know, the next president is going to be either a PDP candidate or an APC candidate. That's facts. And Osinbajo, to my mind, when I look across everybody else in APC, whether it's a Tinubu or an El-Rufai or even a Fayemi or a Fashola, I think he would cause the least harm to me and my people. So it would make sense for him to get the ticket. It's almost like self-preservation. I want PDP to win. I think we are going to produce better candidates, but Osinbajo represents the least harm for me. So I would be happy to see him get the APC ticket.
And you think the PDP? You think you can defeat him, Jose? You think
okay? Can I speak now?
Okay, family, quickly, 2-3 minutes.
All right, Osa, thank you very much for really speaking the facts and truth about the vice president. But you see, where I'll fault you is saying he's going to be the least when it comes to you. If so, you are indirectly saying we should field APC should field an Osinbajo, and you feel you guys the PDP has better candidates to defeat.
Oh, no. That's what I'm saying. I think for me, for my personal, you know, because I always say politics is personal interest. I think for me, the PDP should field, I would want to see a Makinde, because to me, he would, I don't think he'll get the ticket, but a Makinde represents for me my best hope. You know, he would build a Nigeria that would, I would be able to prosper within more than any of the other candidates, I believe. And I'm saying when I look at APC, Osinbajo represents the candidate that would do me the least harm, if that makes any sense. Not that he is the weakest candidate, you know, but he would do more good than any of the other candidates are able to do. That's what I mean. So not that he's the weakest, but he would cause me the least harm. That's what I was trying to say.
Okay. Have you put in consideration the political calculation when you are making this.
I have, and it sort of is a shame that you know, political calculation would put someone like a Tinubu ahead of Osinbajo.
I'm not talking about the Tinubu Osinbajo. I'm speaking to you as a member of PDP and looking at all your candidates and looking at the political calculation and looking at where your strengths are in political votes compared to the APC, and you feel you have the upper hand even if they put a Makinde. I'm just throwing that question to you. Your own best candidate.
Sorry, guys. because of time, we need to focus. Sorry, we can have this conversation after the podcast. But we need to move on to the next topic because of time. And this is the appointment of Doyin Salami as President Buhari's chief economic advisor. Doyin Salami, prior to that, was the chairman of Buhari's Economic Advisory Council. And we've had this conversation about him in the past on this podcast because Phoenix likes him and I like him as well, because for the sole reason that he's a graduate of Queen Mary College, University of London, which is where I did my bachelor's degree. So I like him for that. But aside from that, so the first question to Phoenix, this new appointment of your mentor to the position of chief economic advisor, is this a fantastic decision? And are we expecting results based on this appointment, Phoenix?
Michael, I mean, for me, it's a head scratcher. So because I was looking at it from his perspective and wondering why he took it, but maybe as the days went by, I then rationalized it that, I mean, he's already the chairman of the Presidential Economic Advisory Council, so. I mean, you might as well. I mean, it's just formalizing what he's been doing. So maybe that's how I've come to accept it, because I couldn't understand why he would do so. I mean, this is a government that has steadfastly refused to have a chief economic advisor for 7 years, and then decides in the last year of the presidency to do so. And you're like, anybody that understands economics knows that. I mean, this is too late for anything to happen. So unless he's banking on continuity of government, in the sense that maybe he believes that, whoever comes out of the APC will win and therefore there will be continuity. With the economy, any policy changes you make or anything you bring to bear from a monetary or a fiscal policy direction, it takes time for you to pass through, for you to see the effects. It's not going to happen in 1 year. So there's no way that Doyin Salami's appointment is going to move the needle within the next year. Bearing in mind that even the budget for 2022 has been finalized, has been signed. And that is your number one policy instrument. So really, it's just window dressing. It's just formalizing a role that he had for a long time. As you said, I am a big fan of Dr. Doyin Salami. I believe in his work. I believe that he's one of our top economic minds. It's always baffled me why he was why he chose to be in bed with this government, which is antithetical to some of the positions he takes. He's a free market proponent, but also a very pragmatic one. He's anti-subsidy. So a lot of those things, I mean, if you go back and read, when he was on the Monetary Policy Committee of the Central Bank, you go back and read his statements then, you will see somebody who was very open to going against the grain and very clear on you're making the wrong choices, even on FX policy. So for me, when he took on the chairmanship of the Economic Advisory Council, I celebrated it because I hoped that it would bring some change. I haven't seen that change happen. And therefore, him taking on this role for me was just baffling in the sense that it's too late. Nothing is going to change. And I just hope that, you know, like we say in Nigeria, that it doesn't end up staining his white. So that's where I leave it. It's just window dressing for me as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you, Phoenix. Let me bring in Ose before I go to Famile. Ose, as a member of the PDP, what is your response? Because as far as I can see, he's been a chairman of the Economic Advisory Council before this new appointment, and we've seen data from the Nigerian Bureau of Statistics that have shown we've had two recessions, record unemployment, record inflation. So do you foresee any new changes now that he's changed his hat?
It was an unusual appointment for me. And I think it was even more surprising that he accepted it. And the last time we heard from, is it Dr. Salami or Professor Salami? He was criticizing or warning about the levels of debt Nigeria was accumulating. And I think at the time he said debt service is about 98%. I saw some data saying it's almost 100% now. And he was warning about, you know, an unsustainable debt hangover, and was actually proposing things that the government should do. But it was interesting that his proposals at the time, as you recall from our last podcast, he was speaking to what the states should be doing. He really wasn't talking to the federal government. And he just sort of like suggested that the federal government wasn't listening. So he was now talking to states that they should try and improve revenue by blocking leakages, improving tax efficiency, and selling off dead assets, etc. So I don't understand this appointment. It only started to make sense to me when the president started waxing lyrical about Professor Doyin Salami's presentation about 2.5% of land being cultivated, again, which was totally incorrect. And maybe he wants Dr. Salami to spearhead this new march back to the farm to sort of like rekindle Nigeria's economic engine. The problem with this, and I'm sure Doyin Salami already knows, is that the NBS itself has said that agriculture, sustenance agriculture, is a poverty trap. It's the one guaranteed way to keep you in poverty. Again, the reports are on the NBS site. I've heard the former DG of the NBS say this at one of these their online Zoom meetings at the time, that the poorest people in Nigeria, and the thing guaranteed to keep you poor, is subsistence agriculture. So it sort of is curious hearing the president pull towards that direction. And I wonder how Dr. Salami is going to handle that tension that will inevitably arise. Agriculture is one of the largest contributors to our GDP. But paradoxically, because it's such a poverty trap, is one of the reasons why we are the poverty capital of the world. I think ultimately he's going to be a fall guy. Nigeria will struggle, and they'll blame it on this brilliant professor from Lagos.
Thank you, Jose. Final question to you, Famile. What a number of people have asked is, Buhari has less than, I think, maybe 18 months to go. It's probably even less than that before he leaves office. So the question is, he's already submitted his budget for 2022, which has already been passed. So what really can this new chief economic advisor add to Buhari, especially as both of them don't even agree on economic policy, and Buhari has always ignored his advice? So what is the point to this appointment, Famile?
All right, thank you very much. So we just have to look at it. Even if you're in support of any government or any person, we should always speak the truth and speak the facts. He has always been, the chairman of the economic team. Yeah, and you have said something good about him. Phoenix have said something good, or say have said something good about Salami. And my question is, he has been there as the chairman of the economic committee. Is it that the government, and based on the statistics, yes, even if we don't want to agree on statistics, because, but based on what let me quote Phoenix when he quoted all the stats from the Bureau of Statistics and everything, and he has been the chairman, and you spoke highly of him. So my question is, he has been there. Is it that the government has not been listening to him or taking his advice? Or they've appointed him now to take full charge that we want to listen to him? That's the question that comes to my head, because no one needs to tell anybody that the economy is not where it's supposed to be. We all know that the economy of Nigeria is not where it's supposed to be. And we all know the direction of the president when it comes to the economy of Nigeria. We can't shy away from that, even if you are a supporter of the president or not. We all know his direction when it comes to the economy of Nigeria and when he brings up his own agricultural statistics, in which it's not the road I want to go. But at the moment, if I was the chief, I was the chairman of the economic committee or team, and they don't used to listen to me, and all of a sudden now they come and say, come and be the chief economic advisor in 1 year and 6 months. So I want to ask myself, what do I want to do? What do they expect from me now? Are they going to listen to me? Or they've been listening to me all the while? So I've been asking myself this. Everyone here has spoken highly of Salami. And right now we have 1 year and how many months to go? He has now been fully appointed as the chief economic advisor. And everyone here has spoken and given statistics about the Nigerian economy in which he has been heading it. So my question is still the same thing. Is it that the government have not been listening to him? Or it takes time for the economy to pick up with his own advice? So for me, it's never late than ever. It's never late anyway. He has taken the position. He knows better. If according to us, he has come out to criticize our debts or that, and still decided to take on this appointment, then I think he knows better. So let's see what will change in this little 1 year and 6 months that he has taken this appointment. Let's see. I'm not here to say what I really don't know, but let's just see, because he has been there over time. And according to statistics of the day that was even quoted here, we can see that the economy is not doing well. So let's see whether with this new appointment, there will be a new dimension. I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you, Famile. Final question on this topic is to you, Phoenix. Phoenix, they said you've quoted statistics, you've described the man as an excellent man. So why are things not working, Phoenix?
It sounds like you read my mind, because I was actually going to say something to that. I think it just speaks to the concern that Osei raised, right? That, I mean, he will potentially be the fall guy. I think he's put himself in the crosshairs, and so whatever comes, he should just take it like that. I mean, he's an adult. I totally agree with Famile, and I have also asked those questions. That look, why would you be chairman of Economic Advisory Council and they're not listening to you, if that is the case, and you are still there, and then now you decide to take on a more formal position? But let's not forget that the original position that he had as chairman of the Presidential Economic Advisory Council was not an executive position. You don't hold any sway over any of the ministers. You give advice. On that same council, we had, I believe, Bismarck Irani was there and Charles Soludo. And so there was supposed to be a council of top economic eggheads who were supposed to guide the government. But we also know that Buhari has his own clear economic agenda and has followed that through. And his agents, be it the finance minister or the central bank governor, follow their own path. Now, as chief economic advisor, it's also still going to be a lot in the advisory capacity. But as I said, he's put a target on his back. He's going to live and die with the results of the government. The point I'm making is that it's window dressing, in the sense that I mean, who's taking the government seriously when you've gone through 7 years of your administration with no economic advisor in that formal capacity and then decide a year to go that, oh, now let me put one in, when you clearly know that there's really nothing else for them to do. So I fully agree that, Salami would have to take, and that's what's going to happen. We're already seeing it. I mean, Famili is already questioning, I mean, whether he wasn't, I mean, the data is clear that the economy has not done well and you've been in there. So what have you done? So the next 1 year, that's what's going to also happen. People will have expectations. This economy will not improve significantly and he will bear the brunt of that as well. So whether it enables deflect, because again, we're in political season. And we also remember that one of the things that has happened without having a chief economic advisor is the VP was really the head of the economic management council of this particular government. That's been what we've had from day one of this government. So maybe it's a way to deflect the attention from the VP who wants to run as president by having somebody else be the chief economic advisory council in the last moments. And that person be the one who carries the can, while the VP can then run without that tag being on him as having led a failure of the government, of the economy. Maybe. But we're in political season and there's going to be a lot of discussion on this, I'm sure.
Thank you, Phoenix. Well, we'll see how things play out. We'll see whether Doyin Salami becomes the fall guy or if Buhari and Oshibanjo take responsibility. Now to our final topic. The governor of Kaduna State, Nasir El-Rufai, in an exclusive interview with Arise TV, came up with his own proposal for tackling the security crisis in the north of Nigeria. He says we should ignore collateral damage and carpet bomb all the forests in the north. He said, yes, we can rebuild the trees later. And he says, yes, he knows there'll be collateral damage, but all in all, insecurity will become a thing of the past. So firstly, to Osir, is this idea from the, or this proposal from the Kaduna State governor, is this something the PDP will sign up to?
I know Rufai. He's a very, very brilliant man. You know, I served with him when he was in BPE, well, in DG of the Bureau of Public Enterprises, I think it was. I saw what he did as Minister of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. I rooted for him in 2007 when I thought he could actually become president of this country, which is why this new person in Kaduna, this fundamentalist bigot, I don't know whether I can say bigot without being sued, this guy, this character in Kaduna State that is doing these things, that is dividing his state, and he's making statements like this. This wasn't even the first time he has used this type of language. I remember when students were kidnapped and he was saying he was encouraging or urging that they go in with lethal force, you know, to kill the kidnappers, that yes, some students might have been lost, but you know, it is what it is. You know, and it wasn't just carpet bomb Kaduna's forest, for instance, we're talking about. He said across the northeast, the northwest, I think even included Niger, the Nigerian military should coordinate the carpet bombing of all the all the forests in northern Nigeria to kill everybody in the forest. And yes, there might be some civilians. I mean, we forget that most of the north is forest and is arable land. A lot of farmers and the rest. You also have a lot of rural communities even nestled within all these forest. It was Famili that was telling us that Sambisa Forest alone is the size or is bigger than the southeast. So for this really educated man to try to push a strategy that people like America, I think, even tried and failed spectacularly with in Vietnam, to say the solution to this problem, the solution to banditry and terrorism is to bomb all the forests in the north. Kill everybody in the forest. There might be some civilians, but this is the way to go. I mean, you can replant the trees, and unfortunately, you can't plant people, but it is what it is. It's shocking. I think maybe he said it flippantly. Maybe he said it for the headlines. I've always said he's trying to position himself as Buhari 2.0. So he's the more extreme, more fundamental defender of the faith, no-nonsense type of strong man that Buhari was. And maybe it's with this type of shock tactic that he's hoping to inherit Buhari's mantle. But it was a stupid proposal. It probably, I'm sure, would classify as a war crime. Thankfully, our Nigerian military is led by people who have a lot more level heads than El-Rufai. So I don't think we will ever see the carpet bombing of all Nigeria's northern forests anytime soon.
Thank you, Bose. Before I come to Phoenix, let me go to Famile. Because Famile, I know you mentioned that you had some things to say when you were speaking earlier. So do you agree with Governor El-Rufai's proposals that we need to carpet bomb the forests? And yes, there'll be collateral damage, but it's worth it. Is that something you agree with, Famile?
Yeah, all right. When you listen to that interview, and he gave several explanations, definitely, we know the rules of engagement. You just can't go and begin to bombard. But you see, they say it's who that wears the shoe that knows where it pains. As a governor of a state that has been ravaged by banditry, every day there's something happening in Kaduna State. With all the positives he has brought into the state, it still boils down to one thing: insecurity in Kaduna, insecurity in the roads of Kaduna, kidnapping and killings every day. You know? So, and he said something, he said, we don't have enough boots on ground. Please, I'm not in support of bombarding the forest. We don't have enough boots on ground. I have spoken, he said, when I came into government, we had about 13,000 policemen. I've even spoken with the IG, and he said, yes, we'll recruit up to 10,000. And he said, how do you spend 10,000 policemen over the 36 states? If they bombard Sokoto, they move. The army will move to Sokoto, bombard them again. The same bandits will move here. So I believe he was just speaking out of, you know, if we can just bombard the whole place and kill these whole bandits, yes, there'll be collateral damage. There has not been any war that has not been collateral damage. But I'm just thinking, he's just speaking like, okay, it's getting too much. We don't have any security. Our security personnel on ground cannot even manage the whole of Northeast. When, you know, and this thing is increasing every day. If they attack here, they attack the soft villages, they move here, they attack here, you know. And it was like, okay, this is a governor that has even paid bandits. He has tried every possible option within his own powers to see that, okay, he can be able to curb the insecurity. I'm not saying whether his options were the best, but I'm just trying to look into his mind. I'm seeing the direction he was going into. But look, let's bomb this whole place. Let there be collateral damage, at least. There are some things you do with little evil for a greater good. And I think that's the part he's looking at. But definitely, this is not the way, the war doesn't work that way at this moment, that you just go and bombard the whole forest and say, yes, you are just trying to eliminate all the bandits. Definitely, there are rules of engagement. So we should be looking at more security intelligence, thinking of more pragmatic ways we can go about security. Definitely. But I just think he was just speaking out of his mind, like, you know, it's too much. I know definitely, like Osei has said, he's an intelligent man. He knows that that can't work. But he was just trying to show Nigerians that, look, I'm not taking sides in this banditry. I just want to see that if it can end, it can end. Because I know for a fact, in fact, structurally wise, economically wise, Kaduna State is doing well. But you give zero when it comes to security, zero. If today you pass Abuja-Kaduna Road, you manage to cross that road, today you thank your God. Tomorrow you hear again. Then the security forces will go there again and fight those bandits. It will be safe for 1 week. Next week, they're back again, you know? And he's the governor of the state. Then tomorrow, they're attacking here, they're attacking there. So it's zero. Whatever he's doing in the state, whatever turnarounds he has brought into the state, is really not showing because of the security lapses. So definitely I know he knows that this can work, but he's just saying it out of, from his larger heart, showing that, look, I just want these things to end. If there's a way we can just bomb this whole place to end, but definitely he knows the rules of engagement that you cannot work that way. So, but for this government, I don't know. We have to, they have to come up with more pragmatic ways to solve this security, this banditry in the north. Definitely we know how porous the north is. And when you look at some of these villages, these are really soft targets. If you have a good knowledge about the north, you will know that it's very easy to attack. There's so much land, there's so much population and soft targets everywhere for these people to operate. And at the end of the day, you know where they are going to. They are still going to hide inside those forests and take all the kidnapped victims and use as human shield. So, but like he said, we don't have enough boots on ground. I think we should do a lot of more recruitment, more equipment, and come up with more intelligence and a way to curb it. Thank you.
Can I just say something very quickly, Phoenix? Sorry.
Okay. 1 minute.
It's also interesting to note that one of the loudest advocates for state police as the way out of insecurity in the Northwest has been El-Rufai himself. And he's been championing it loudly and vocally. He did in February, in May, in October, and even in December. So it was also interesting watching his president say that state police is not on the table.
Thank you, Jose, for that contribution. Now, let me bring in Phoenix. Phoenix, family has taken, he'll correct me if I'm wrong, a sort of sympathetic view. And he said that El-Rufai has done excellently, has performed excellently in terms of infrastructure and the economy of Kaduna State, that it's security that's the problem, and is out of that frustration because his intentions are noble and good. And it's that frustration that he cannot seem to get to grips with security that has made him lash out and say, look, let's just carpet bomb the whole place. So it's more of a statement of frustration as opposed to a statement of intent. Do you agree with Familia that that's what El-Rufai's motivations are, Phoenix?
I think El-Rufai has consistently shown a lack of regard for human life that always gives me cause for concern, and this is just further evidence of it. We've seen it over time, the manner they handled the Shiite massacre, or him threatening to send some people back in body bags and all of that. So there's a pattern of behavior that one can allude to. And that concerns me, and has always been one of the main concerns why I think he should never be anywhere near the presidency of this country. He's just too volatile in character. He thinks in a certain sort of way that for a country as ours, that is as diverse, is a recipe for disaster. So, but that's on one point. So his idea of carpet bombing, let's take a look on. I mean, my view on that is, number one, any of this banditry and terrorist activity, I've always believed that we need to go in with significant force. I've held Buhari to account and said that he hasn't treated it with as much seriousness as he should, and that we need to deal with this with these people with extreme prejudice, to wipe them out, to send a very clear message that we will not accept taking up arms against the state. I mean, taking up arms and, you know, hurting vulnerable people, all the deaths that we've seen. So I'm all for force. But I'm also all, to Familia's point, for intelligent use of force, backed by, you know, good intelligence, backed by, proper setup of the state security apparatus, not only in terms of, what's his name? El-Rufai makes a very good point that I've also said several. I don't understand why 7 years in, we haven't significantly, with all the various theaters where our security forces have been engaged, why we haven't significantly upgraded the number of security forces that we have, to combat this issue and make sure that we can truly bring it to an end. So there needs to be a concerted and clever effort to bring the insecurity issues to an end. We haven't seen that. But somebody then trying to use carpet bombing of our forests as the measure of that, as it doesn't make sense, especially if you're a Nigerian who is aware of our history of the lack of precision of our Air Force. I mean, anybody who remembers RAN, who remembers was also in Bornu where, I mean, our own Air Force bombed our own military and killed over 20 officers. I mean, there are a litany of instances where, I mean, we've seen innocent people, civilians. I mean, we've seen friendly fire kill our own forces. For anybody to think that it makes sense to ask the same Air Force to go and simply, go on a wide bombing spree, it doesn't make any sense. So yes, while I agree that we need maximum force to send a very clear message and to be relentless to pursue, I remember in the early days of 2015, I mean, the relentless pursuit strategy that they used that pushed back significantly and allowed elections to happen and allowed the new incoming government to at least take over from a position of strength where they had pushed back Boko Haram significantly. If we have such a strategy where we have an enhanced military capability, both in terms of men and equipment, pursue an attack, and then you have more precision in terms of how you're targeting, how you're dealing with these bandits, then that makes sense. But not to simply, based on our history, tell our Air Force to simply go and be bombing our forest and to just, off the cuff say, I mean, collateral damage can be accepted. I'm sorry, no elected official, no leader of any sane country should be saying that kind of thing. And it speaks to the character of the man. So that's my view on this.
Thank you, Phoenix. Let me come back to Famile quickly. Famile, in 1 minute, you've heard what Phoenix has said. He said, look, this statement by Orofai is not a one-off. In the past, he said things, for example, he said, if peacekeepers come to interfere in Nigeria, they will go home in body bags. He's supported the execution of numerous Shiite members sometime in 2015. So he has a record of making comments that seem to show disregard for human rights. So is it really correct when you say he was speaking out of frustration, or is this more the character of the man that he doesn't respect human rights, Famile?
All right. Well, I'm not here to defend certain statements. Definitely, I'm not here to defend a statement of people going back in bags or all that. Anyway, it's Al-Rufai. Yes, even if I support him in certain things, doesn't mean I'll support certain things anyway. But coming back to that, his statement, like I said, definitely he has made utterances like this. Yes, all correct. I agree with Phoenix. Well, it can be his character, definitely. I'm not here to I can't support that kind of character where there's no respect for human life anyway. But like I said, well, it's very easy for one to speak. I don't know what is deep inside his heart, if truly, but as an elected official, we should always guard our utterances. But like I said, he's the governor of the most volatile state presently in Nigeria, with insecurity. So I definitely, you just have to give him a benefit of that when he makes certain utterances, because he's been affected every day on, I believe, as a governor of that state, waking up every day, oh, people have kidnapped, or they've killed this person in this village, they've killed that, they've killed this, waking up to this kind of news every day, and you really cannot do so much. You are bound to make utterances like this. but at the same time, you should be guarded. But trying to judge his character, yes, you have all the rights, according to Phoenix, to judge his character based on certain utterances. Anyway, I'm not here to defend that, because definitely everybody heard when he heard up spoke about the peacekeepers. Well, concerning the Shiites and how it was handled, I don't, and maybe his utterances, I can't really remember, but definitely, you know, I'm not here to back up anything that has to do with no respect for human life anyway. But I was just trying to explain to you that definitely he knows that that cannot be done anyway, going to bombard the forest, whether he's speaking out loud or speaking out from his heart, you know, but it's just a sign of showing, I would love to just see these bandits or banditry coming to an end. Whatever ways that can be done, let's just get it done. Like Osea said, he's a believer of state police. He was part of the one that headed the committee of restructuring. Definitely, he had come up with his own ideas or policies, and his own government of the day must have not even taken that into consideration one way or the other. So you what do you expect him to say or do? You know, and I believe in his own capacity, he has given his own security advice or whatever he feels that can work. But maybe his present government of the day has not taken those advice anyway. So I can't judge his character, but on that, but he has made utterances that can make anyone judge his character and say maybe he doesn't respect human life. But like I said, for this particular utterance, definitely, like you rightly said, it's out of frustration he must have said it. It might be that he's just crying out loud or trying to make Nigerians feel, oh, I'm not taking side, because when it comes to insecurity of Kaduna State, some people feel he's sympathetic to the bandits or taking sides with the bandits. And maybe just coming out to say, look, I'm not taking sides. I want it to end. If they can bombard everywhere, bombard the whole place. So that's my own take.
Thank you, family. Also, is that your hand up or no? Sorry, I must be misreading things. Well, thank you, family. Our time is up now. So, firstly, we'll say thank you to our two guests. Thank you, Osei. Thank you, family, for taking our time to be here. Thank you, Phoenix, for co-hosting this podcast with me. And last but not least, thank you to our listeners for always giving us helpful feedback and for being loyal. Until same time next week, I say have a fantastic 7 days to everyone.
Thanks, family. Thanks, Osei, for joining us. Look forward to having you guys right back. Thank you, Michael, and thanks, listeners. Have a great week, everyone.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening to us. We hope we just try to speak from what we know and what we from our own different opinions. Everyone is subject to their own opinions. All we want to see is a Nigeria moving forward, the better Nigeria. And no matter what we support, no matter what sentiments we have, we should just think Nigeria first. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. As always, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys. Bye.